Right, so we move on to the Interpretations Committee. Michael.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, good afternoon, everybody. In this session this afternoon, we want to principally focus on a particular technical accounting issue that we would appreciate your input on. And then we'll move on to just a few minutes at the end, looking at an overview of what the Interpretation Committee has been working on, what its activities have been over the last year or so. But first of all, starting off with this technical issue, this is one that had been discussed by the Interpretations Committee a few years ago. We had some discussions with the board as well, and it relates to the purchase of property, plant and equipment where there's a variable price concern and how you deal with accounting for that variability. And it was something that the board had suggested that we hold fire on doing anything with until the leases project had come to a conclusion. And given that all the technical discussions on leases have now completed, we're going to be starting this up again with the Interpretations Committee. And so we wanted to just take a new look at this and get your input on that. And Javed is going to take us through that.
Thanks, Michael. So if you turn to slide 4 basically, it outlines, it provides a brief background on the issue. And like Michael said, it concerns contracts where you've acquired an asset, like either a piece of property, plant and equipment, or an intangible asset. And as part of the consideration, you've agreed to make some variable, you've agreed to pay consideration that's variable. That variability might be based on some form of index, for example, or it might be based on future sales, for example, or meeting certain compliance criteria. So an example of that might be where a pharmaceutical company purchases a drug, and they agree to make certain payments based on whether or not the R&D advances and certain milestones are met. And it's not certain at this stage whether the milestones will be met or not. And the question is, how do you account for these payments? And turning to the next slide, two issues really come to mind. First is, on the day that you acquire the asset, do you have a liability on that date to record these variable payments? Should you estimate the fair value, for example, and record a liability for these, or do you not have a liability until that event actually occurs? And we'll talk about that later on the next slide. And the second issue comes down to, subsequent to the initial recognition, how do you make adjustments to that? And should those adjustments go against the cost of the asset, or should they go against, should they be charged to profit and loss, for example? And we'll talk about that as well later. This problem comes from the fact that currently, for purchases of assets, there's no explicit guidance in the standards on how you account for that. And we understand that there is diversity in practice in these areas and how these are accounted for. So that's what we'd like your views on. But now I'll just talk a little bit about the initial recognition, which is the next slide. And a few alternatives that the committee has discussed in the past and will be looking at again now is, the first alternative would be to say that at the date you acquire the asset, you have a liability and you should record a liability for all these variable payments. You should estimate the fair value, for example, and record a liability on day one. The other alternative would be the other extreme, alternative 3, which would be to not record a liability at all for these payments until the event actually occurs. And the other alternative, which is alternative 2 on your slide, which is to say that you have a liability for certain of these payments and you don't have a liability for some of these payments. So for example, like if you look at what the leases project has done with variable consideration, they say where you have variable consideration where it's based on an index for a rate, you should record a liability initially. And for every other form of variable payment, you should not record a liability. So that's another alternative that can be considered for initial measurement. So those are some of the alternatives that we're looking at the moment. Moving along to subsequent recognition and measurement. Again, some of the alternatives are, so if you have recognized these liabilities initially and you have subsequently you have an adjustment to the estimate that you're going to pay, the question is, should that adjustment go to the asset or should you record that through profit and loss? So those are obviously two of the alternatives. Record it through the asset, record it through P&L. Or another alternative would be, again, certain adjustments go against the cost of the asset, certain adjustments go against profit and loss. And you could also say, well, it really depends on whether or not you recognized the liability initially or you haven't recognized the liability initially. That's really kind of what the leases project has gone with. So they said, to the extent you've recognized the liability for variable payments based on an index or a rate, and you have adjustments to the amount, those should go against the cost of the asset, against the right of use asset in the lease of project. And for other payments, for example, variable payments based on revenues, they've just said when you have adjustments to those should be recorded through profit and loss. So that's another approach that we could look at over here. So that's just a very high level summary of the accounting issues that we are considering as part of this project. And on the next slide, you'll see we have a few questions, both for members of the CMAC group and for members of the GPF group. And we'd like to open the floor up for some comments on these questions. So some of the things we're looking at, for example, from the CMAC members are to see, for these type of transactions, what information would you find useful? What disclosures would you find useful? And in the previous slides that we have, the alternatives that we discussed, do you think any of these alternatives would meet your needs? Or is there something else that you suggest that we look at as well? And similarly for the GPS members, we'd like to know your views on what you've seen in practice in these type of transactions, and which alternative do you think is really feasible and practical to implement, keeping in mind what the investors want as well. So with that, I'd like to open the floor.
So presumably there's diversity in practice at the moment on this, hence exactly. It's come to the Interpretations Committee.
Exactly.
Okay, now do you want the CMAC members to go first? Because I noticed we've got GPF members eager.
Yes, that would be helpful if the CMAC members can start off by saying what they want, and then...
So we do have CMAC members. So Mitch and then...
I'll hazard a guess at this.
Okay.
I guess my view would be, an entity bought this asset, made a valuation on the asset,
yes,
with the expectation that it would deliver the cash flows in the future, otherwise it wouldn't, whatever valuation came up.
Right.
So as such, it has probable cause to believe that those cash flows will, the profit of the cash flows will exist. Therefore, whatever carve out that would make sense to me that you would have to reserve against that because you think there's probable cause,
right,
for those cash flows to happen. So it just seems that, and as a consumer of that, so my sense would be, yeah, you probably should reserve against it because you bought the asset because you thought it was going to work and generate some cash. And then as a consumer, I'd say, yeah, you should reserve against those liabilities. It will probably pay out over time. Just take that hit now as part of the full package of the acquisition.
Yeah. So that answers the first one.
Do I have to answer all of them?
Yeah. Didn't realize. So on slide six, your alternative one, recognize the liability for all variable payments.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So then perhaps the more difficult one is, so when your estimate of that variable payment changes,
yeah,
where does it go?
Whether to the P&L or to the
cost of the asset, yeah.
Yeah, it's a difficult one because it's a bit like the pensions. You would deck it through to the P&L when you make changes for the pension. I think perhaps the problem there is it does create a little more volatility in earnings than I know some of us are okay, comfortable with that. Seem more appealing, so that prefer that that could set aside. So I don't know if that necessarily needs to flow through the P&L.
Okay, might circle back to that. Mariella?
I'm just a little bit confused because I think that basically sort of an additional contingent consideration in terms of the payment or whatever would not arise unless you actually change your view on the value of the asset because of specific triggers. So, in the pharmaceutical space, you have that quite a lot. Let's say you buy a biotech company and you say we pay you $300 million now, and if the main project you have in development reaches phase three, we pay you another $100 million and so forth. So wouldn't you basically If that milestone is reached and you have to pay the additional $100 million, you would book that through the P&L, that change, but you would also revalue the asset and say it's now worth more because the probability of that drug coming to market and ultimately generating huge So I would assume you always kind of do the two. And I just one comment I just wanted to make in general is that I think for me, it's very important to understand the difference between a naked expense and a covered expense. So, if an expense really only arises as and when you have significant additional profits coming in that more than cover that expense, for me as an analyst, that is a very different situation to one where you have to make a contingent payment just because the success probability has increased. But there could still be, development, regulatory, commercial failure, or something like that.
Any other
Can I just come back? You mentioned you'd be interested to see the asset revalued. Now, typically, we don't see intangible assets being revalued. We just keep them at cost. So rather than recording the payment, the expense of the payment, as an expense in profit or loss, would capitalizing that cost be a good substitute for revaluing the asset?
Capitalizing that additional cost? I guess, yes. Yeah, so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the alternative for making such arrangement is to pay a fixed price. And and the fixed price is probably going to be higher. What you will see is that if you only recognize it when it materializes, suddenly, obviously, you have success on your hands. And then you see a fall in profitability because you at once recognize these additional costs. So there is something to say for a fair value approach here, because that is a more gradual recognition of the implicit option or the explicit option. Mm-hmm. I would be a bit confused to see suddenly a significant increase in cost, whereas basically you had success on your hands. So the signal from the P&L is negative, whereas the signal from the underlying business is actually quite positive.
So you're saying fair value?
That would support a fair value approach here.
What if the fair value uplift was greater than the variable payments that you made? Would you book that net gain in the income statement?
What if the?
So there's a variable payment which you pay if there's success.
Yeah.
But maybe the variable payment is less than the gain that you make because of that success. So overall, you're better off even after making that variable payment.
Yeah.
Would a revaluation approach in that situation lead you to book a gain in the income statement equal to the full value uplift of the pharmaceutical or whatever it is?
Difficult question. I'm not sure if I understand.
It'd be no different from just revaluing your intangible assets. Exactly. That's effectively what it would be.
Revalue.
Did you say that, or were you talking about fair value of the liability? I got confused in the discussion.
Fair value of the asset. The question was, if it's 30 initially.
Yeah.
And then your conditional payment was a further 30, but now the asset's worth 100.
Yeah.
Would you book the extra 40 to the income statement?
I would be hesitant somehow.
Why?
No.
Okay, this is what GPS is.
Reveal my ignorance again. Sort of, why would the payment when you make an acquisition, it doesn't throw through P&L, it's a cap, So why, therefore, would those further payments necessarily go through the P&L? It's just future payment on an asset made. So why? I mean, it's an actual question. I don't understand.
There's a conceptual argument to Stephen's position. When you bought the asset, let's say 30,
right?
because the other guy still had an interest,
yeah,
you actually haven't got 100% of the asset.
Yeah.
So by buying out, by making the conditional payment, by buying out his interest, current accounting standards state that when you move from associates to control, you uplift the underlying value of your assets to the new controlled fair value. And so it is, as this person's, is this conditional payment mean the person's actually got, if I'm getting you right, the conditional interest, which means you actually haven't got control on day one.
And I was thinking more of it in an earnout situation,
yes.
Not in a control situation. That's the way I was thinking about it.
Not an earnout.
Yeah, I was thinking more of the earnout situation, which was my question. It's like still the tail of that consideration for the asset you acquired. Why would it go through the P&L?
And I answer it that way because that's the problem we have in mining, where we will access a junior.
Right.
And let them continue the exploration, try and continue finding the asset. So although we have 100% of the shares, we actually aren't controlling because they're continuing to use that money we pay to find more so that we can give them that extra conditional.
It's like an equity investment.
It's like a private equity investment. Have you really got control?
We'll find out what you do in a second. Let's find out from Malcolm first what the answer is.
So, yeah, so it's not a surprise you put a pharma product in here as one of the issues, because this is, to be honest, one of the biggest challenges in the pharma industry. And we have a completely different model for accounting for if we make a business combination compared to making a single asset purchase. So, I think there was a burning need to have the same accounting model between IFRS 3 and the other two standards. Now, to be honest, my preferred approach, which is not on the table, would be for you to reassess IFRS 3 and take contingent consideration out from that and amend that. But if that's not on the table, then let me just explain to you typically, and this is Marietta, you've been in our group talking a lot about milestones and things. So let me just go through a little bit the scenario, and I apologize if I bore people. We buy in so-called early stage compound from a biotech company, and pharmaceutical products typically have 3 stages, 1, 2, 3, depending on what trials you're doing. So we would buy in a product from a biotech. Let's say we do a business combination, an acquisition. So we do an acquisition of a biotech or a company with an early stage product, then we would actually have to go through a probability of success as regards to contingent consideration. So it might be the deal is with the owner of that biotech, we become the shareholder, we actually have these commitments to pay to the old shareholders certain amounts, depending, and it could be, certain milestones, it could be amounts that we pay eventually should the product come to market, so therefore the future royalties. So in a business combination model, we have to come up with a so-called probability of success of all these different events happening, and that's the value that we put into our purchase price allocation. And that is considered to be the historic cost of the purchase price allocation. Now, as the probability, and let's just stay with that scenario, as time passes and you go through these different stages, the probability of success, therefore our liability, changes. But under the existing accounting model, unfortunately, you and me and many of you are saying, well, if it's more likely you're going to have to pay money over to the old shareholders, then actually, sure, why can't you activate that? Why can't you capitalize it? You've got increased value, what you eventually are paying over to the former shareholders is actually an increase in your intangible asset. But that's not the way the business combination standard goes. You have to expense it because by increasing the value, potentially you get into whole goodwill calculations, etc. So we would love actually that in a business combination scenario where we have to true up these estimates and true up our liabilities, that the matching entry is also increasing the value of what we have on the books. To the extent. Now, but it's not the fair value, because the fair value could be hundreds of millions more. But it's a sort of a modified cost basis. So we very much would appreciate not having to expense that true-up, but being allowed to put it as a modified cost basis.
And if it's not a business combination, but an asset purchase, and that's exactly what you're doing, isn't it?
And if it's an asset purchase, the milestones, and there's a difference actually under IAS 38 with US GAAP here, under IFRS 38, milestones do get capitalized. Amazingly, under US GAAP, they do not get capitalized. They're written off as sort of in-process R&D, which is not capitalized. So milestones, as they become due, but not on a true-up basis, we do capitalize them. But of course, we never get to the situation, and that's a bit the strange thing with the business combination model with contingent consideration. In the business combination valuation of the intangible asset, we also have to value the future royalties, which of course, hopefully there's never going to be a suggestion in an asset deal that you're going to also, as you pay royalties, you capitalize them, you know, on future sales. But if you're going to change it, and as I say, the preference would be to change IFRS 3, but that's not on the table, you should have the same accounting treatment for buying an asset. Take out the accounting arbitrage. And yes, that would mean that as you pay milestones, you actually do book it to as an asset, because it changes your asset base. Well, as I say, under the business combination model, you actually, the true the liability is not being recorded as an asset. So yes, we strongly encourage you, but whether it's an interpretation or whether it's a more fundamental change in the standard, that I leave to you, but something needs to happen.
Can I just check one thing with you, Markham? So until the time that, you know, the milestone actually comes through, so you say to the biotech, we'll pay you 50
if
million upfront,
it gets capitalized.
What?
If it's an asset deal, you have to make a distinction between
the
amounts paid to
previous
shareholders in a business combination,
yeah,
or the amounts that we're buying in, you know, buying a product from a biotech. Then that's a single asset.
Yeah.
Typically, it's a single. It's not a business combination.
So my question is, if you in-license a single asset, and you say, okay, you know, if the asset passes, I don't know, phase three, we pay you a milestone of 200 million.
Only on payment. It's not treated as a liability. It's shown as a commitment. We show it as a commitment, but it's not shown anywhere as a, I mean, I think we argue it's a sort of executory contract. You could argue it's, I mean, we've had with some technical people at PwC, one could argue it's a financial liability, that milestone, but we argue it's an executive contract, and only to be accounted for on payment, not as a financial liability. But that's another interesting discussion, as you are well aware.
Markham, on that, in terms of your budgeting and your forecasting of future sales, in the example you're giving, would your sales budgets be saying we're anticipating getting sales from that asset before you actually book it as an asset and liability, or not?
We have very sophisticated models looking into the future in our long-term planning,
yeah,
and obviously we would probabilize in our perhaps not we share with you guys, but internally, we would obviously expect that some of those early stage assets in 3 to 5 years will turn into successful products. So we do have to factor in our long-term budgeting the related cash outflows.
But you would be booking those as a commitment rather than the liability.
But they are not, as I say, from an accounting point of view, those milestones are not considered. We and the industry do not consider those future potential milestone payments as financial liabilities. They are viewed as I think the technical term is equity contracts, and therefore only booked as they become due.
Let's go back to Marietta, and then we'll change to mining in a second.
Yeah, I mean, I think this just ties in with, you know, my concern around the naked versus covered expense, because the milestones you integrate into your contract, they can either just relate to something like clinical data, which increases the probability of success but doesn't guarantee it, or the milestones can relate to actually hard commercial targets. So if you basically say to the biotech company, you know, I'm paying you $300 million as soon as this in-market sales of my product reach $1 billion, there's never any risk of the company going bust, because you're not going to have to pay the $300 million unless, you know, you have something like $800 million incremental profits coming in. Whereas if you have a large enough portfolio of biotech assets where you say, okay, you know, every time you pass phase three, I pay $500 million, you know, you could be out of pocket for years or forever, because, you know, it could pass phase three and still be a complete failure.
We have to analyze those future commitments. Are they related to IP, in which case we believe, and so if we pay something related to the fact that we've demonstrated that the IP has increased, i.e. that it's now possible to get regulatory approval, we believe that is something that we can, that payment should be an asset. If the milestone, and this also happens, which I think is what you're talking about, if the milestone is related to a sales-based royalty, then we set up a liability for that as soon as we start to see that likely to occur, but we also set it up as an asset. So we put it on both sides of the balance sheet, and we only start to expense it once, so we don't really expense it until the milestone is, until the sales base royalty is triggered there.
Yeah, I understand that, but the question is, I mean, where do I actually find kind of that list of commitment that theoretically risks blowing the bank? Because if you have to make enough milestone payments on good phase three data,
you'll see any reputable pharma company detailing its potential commitments.
You won't.
You will. I would argue all of our large big pharma companies will detail their potential, we call them commitments. They're not contingent considerations, but they are research commitments, and we actually schedule them out for the next 5 years. So it's, I think all reputable pharma companies would disclose that. But they're not contingent liabilities under IAS 37.
Yes,
use standards that tell us they are.
Let's move on to mining. But before that, Robert, I wondered if you wanted to come in at all. Sorry, I didn't ask you earlier when we were talking about disclosures.
No, it's fine. Thanks. But mining, you may find me having some comments.
All right, we'll come back to you later. Kevin.
Okay, so we've got two models. And it entirely depends on it relates to, we'll only ever enter into these transactions when we're looking at a person who's a junior explorer, and whether we want to actually buy out their mine site. And so if we are buying them out and they're fading into the sunset as individuals, then we have to make a second payment at the point in time that we declare a reserve. That one we'll capitalize, because that's a contractual commitment to people who are no longer employed, and therefore it's the second payment of an asset. But we'll make that capital payment at the point in time that we hit that trigger, and it'll be part of our capital commitment schedule, which is also, like Malcolm, scheduled out for the next 5 years what our capital commitments are. And these ones, because in this case we have control over the exploration profile and the drilling and everything else, we'd be able to work out which year that is likely to develop into a reserve. But if the individuals, we bought them out, but they're continuing to now be the explorers working for us as employees, well, those we treat as bonuses.
Mm.
Because that's an incentive for them to perform as workers and not a second payment to acquire their rights to the underlying property. So there's a it depends, because they tend to be excluded from the other bonus schedules that we have in the organisation.
Okay, so your alternative 3 on page 6 and alternative 1 on page 7, unless they're employee bonuses.
Yes.
Okay, Bob next.
A couple of comments. Urge caution in making an analogy to business combinations. I don't like the guidance in IFRS 3, but I understand it because there's a need to do a purchase price allocation underneath it. And so when you're doing a purchase price allocation to do the fair value of all the assets and liabilities with goodwill as a residual, you're trying to capture a purchase price that takes into account the contingency. So I see that as a basis for doing business combinations different, even though I don't like it. But I urge caution to doing an analogy for single asset to business combinations. With that, I find it odd that we had a discussion just previously today on IAS 37 talking about contingencies, and this is a contingency. And it seemed to me, unless I misinterpreted it, that the consensus seemed around the table that they were happy with IAS 37, that there would be the recognition threshold of more likely than not, and then on the measurement, it would be the most likely amount. No one has indicated that in this situation, and it's not even an alternative being considered. And I just find it odd, if I interpreted our IAS 37 discussion, that we're totally inconsistent, maybe because there's different fact patterns here, but it's not even an alternative. So I would go with that alternative to be added as an alternative, recognize it was more likely than not, recognize that at the most likely amount, and I would add it to the cost of the asset when you hit those triggers.
Yeah, interesting that you raise IAS 37 and therefore the probability threshold. When the Interpretations Committee looked at this 2 or 3 years ago now, their sort of analysis of it was that this is a liability or a potential liability arising out of a contractual arrangement between two companies. And so they saw this as really being a financial liability. But of course, if you head down the financial liability route under whether it's IAS 39 or IFRS 9, then that says yes, book the liability on day one and book it at its fair value. But as Malcolm was describing, there are some significant difficulties with that, both in terms of sort of the estimating when there is significant uncertainty, plus there is this debate about, well, depending on what the contingency is, if it's about performance that is needs to be undertaken by the company, then should it actually be considered an executory contract, so that whilst it's set out in a contractual arrangement, it doesn't necessarily kick in until you know one party has performed, and therefore leading to the existence of that liability.
That's effectively how ours are structured, because the second payment is a suspensive condition. So it's all included into the original contract, payment one, but payment two suspended, and therefore it hits the executory contract position rather than the financial liability position, because there is no claim until the suspensive condition has been fulfilled.
But I do think you have to be careful about the interest rate type increase, because I think that has some parallels with leasing. And I think about trail commissions you pay on mortgages, where we present value the future trail that you're to pay to the financial planner, because they're part of the overall arrangement. We capitalize that to the asset side. It's an amortized cost model at that point. So I'm in favor of alternative one once you capitalize, once you start to report it. I'd be on alternative two in terms of the liability side. But I agree with Bob's point.
So is this alternative one on page 6, right?
Seven. Look it to the asset.
Yeah, alternative one, look to the asset.
But on page 6 you would be?
Alternative two.
Yeah, which is consistent with the leasing. Standard.
but they're different fact patterns and different triggers, and I think that's the issue. But at least your point is covered in alternative two. We're not according to it.
Martin, earlier you were shaking your head a little bit.
No, first, support for Malcolm's observation on contingent subsequent payments for acquisitions. Okay. I think they should be recorded as goodwill, usually, as an increase in the goodwill, and activate them. You paid more for the assets also.
Either, I mean, you could do both. You could be, or you could put it to goodwill, you could be allowed to change the initial recognition of the historic cost of the identified asset.
I mean, one debate you could have is, you know, these additional payments that need to be made, are they reflecting additional information about what the value of the asset was on day one? Or do they reflect work that has been done since and therefore shouldn't have anything to do with the asset that you bought on day one, because this is about either adding to that asset or something else again?
The problem you
face is, the problem is that the liability that you recognize as contingent consideration is treated like a financial liability and you have to keep truing it up. And we're not allowed to book that true-up of the financial liability into any other place than the income statement. We would like to be allowed to also, as the likelihood of us having to pay that extra amount out, we'd also like to be allowed to incrementally increase the initial recognition value of that intangible asset.
But I think, Malcolm, you keep coming back to business combinations, which is not what this is about.
Well, it would be the same situation if you have to estimate. If you go to the model of saying on day one you've got a liability at some point to, because you've got this, you've got basically contingent consideration related to the single asset purchase. I think you get to the same place, Frank. You have to come up with some estimation of that liability on day one, and you have to true it up as time goes on, and therefore that true up, as you get nearer and nearer to actually having to pay that amount, you should be allowed to, that increase in the liability should go against the initial cost base of your single asset that you bought. You get my point?
Yeah. Steve, my main consideration on the asset would be that, as I said, that I don't want the P&L to give the wrong signals here. That's my primary concern. And that's why I don't like the IFRS 3 the way it is now. And maybe opposed to, as I said earlier about the asset, instead of already recognizing you're getting near to a point that you're going to pay a milestone payment, that's one way to do it. The other way to do it is similar to my suggestion 5+3, is to activate the milestone payment and depreciate that payment when you do it. So to activate the milestone payment, and then you can depreciate on that.
It's okay, but it's the issue is you've got this financial liability in both scenarios until you actually get to the trigger point. And what do you do? You're not, because it's a financial liability, we're not allowed to book the debit related to increasing that liability into any other place.
But that's the answer.
It would be the case with if you change this, you'd have to come up with some estimate of what that contingent consideration is.
Depending upon which options we choose. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why I don't want you to go down the IFRS 3 issue, because of course I've got the IFRS 6 problem that I can't capitalize the exploration expenditure, and therefore I have to create these contractual structures in order to enable me to capitalize this secondary payment. So if you go down the IFRS 3, I'm already in there. You capture me back in IFRS 6 and I show even less of my assets on the balance sheet.
Okay. Robert, did you say you wanted to come back in at the end? No, you don't. Michael.
Okay. Well, if we've covered everything that everybody wants to talk about on the assets purchases, just looking at time, we'll just briefly touch on service concession arrangements. These are a bit more niche, but I do just want to touch on them because if there is some particular experience around the table, we'd be very interested to capture that. So, Javid.
Yeah, I won't, given the time, I won't get a lot into a lot of details on service concession, but suffice to say that within IFRIC, so service concessions are those arrangements where a government or a public sector entity engages someone in the private sector to provide a public service, so for example, to build and operate a road. And IFRIC 12 has a particular accounting model that says, because the operator just has access to the road to provide the services, and they don't actually own the road, IFRIC 12 just provides a model to say, the operator cannot actually record the PP&E, the road, in their books, so what should they record? And it says you either have a financial asset, if you have a right to receive cash from the government, or if you have a right to charge the users of the road, then what you have is basically an intangible asset, which is the right to charge the users. And IFRIC 12 goes and talks about all the accounting considerations under these models, but it does not basically cover a situation when, so normally when an operator performs a service, they will get paid from either the grantor or the users, and IFRIC 12 talks about how you account for those payments, but what it does not address is situations where the operator might have to make a payment to the grantor, so where the consideration is going in the other direction. And that's how this whole question arose, basically. And the issue is, how should you account for those transactions? Again, there's no guidance. And we understand that these payments could be, again, fixed or variable in nature. And we understand from limited outreach that we've done in the past that these are typically treated as executory, and they're generally accounted for when the operator actually has to make the payment. That's when they're accounted for. So the committee again looked at this before and said, how should these payments be accounted for? And so slides 12 to 14 basically list what the preliminary analysis of the interpretations committee was. And what they said was basically they should analyze the substance of the payment. If in exchange for the payment they're getting a distinct good or service or something separate from the arrangement, then obviously you account for that thing separately. And if not, then it's part of the whole service concession arrangement. And if that is the case, what they said was you have to look at whether you're accounting for this under the intangible asset model or the financial asset model, the two models I just outlined. And what they said was if you have an intangible asset model, what you have is basically you're making a payment to the government entity to buy an intangible asset. And if that payment is variable in nature, you've just made a variable payment to buy an intangible asset. And that's really the same consideration that we were discussing previously on the previous issue. Whereas they said if you have a financial asset model, what you have is basically you're getting money, you have a contractual right to receive cash from the government, and you're making a payment in exchange of that as well. And they said then you would look to the revenue standard, which basically says when you have to make a payment to a customer, how do you account for those payments? So that's kind of where they've ended up on the preliminary analysis. What we would like from you is basically to see what your experiences might have been on this and what you've seen. And also, if you think any particular, if you think the analysis done by the Interpretations Committee and the direction that they're going down provides you with the information you want, and from a preparer perspective, is that something that's feasible in terms of preparing financial statements and recording these amounts?
Okay, any, Frank?
We don't in our portfolio have a situation where we actually pay a government agency a fee like this. I could imagine a scenario where when you're in the intangible asset model and you're taking effectively the volume risk as to what's coming through your road toll, you could have a situation where you're sharing with the government a portion of the proceeds you're getting when you're collecting on these roads. I would not like to see that payment being capitalized to the cost of the intangible asset, because I look at the net as being my return on my investment to the intangible up front already. So I do think you have to be careful about the substance of the payment you're making and not just automatically accept it's an additional cost of your
asset. Any other thoughts?
What
I'm just trying to sort of see the difference. You've got a contract of employment with an employee, and you have to pay the employee. You're not capitalising that cost in this situation. You've got a contract with the government to pay them. To me, I'm just looking at it and thinking it's more akin to a licence fee, which is just a part of the annual payment, like a contract of employment. And so capitalising it, I'm struggling to see that.
And where some of the difficulty in the accounting can arise is that if you've got an additional payment to make to the government every year over the life, say the 20-year life of the concession.
Thanks to an employee.
Yeah, and it's escalating. Okay. And the amount that you're allowed to charge the public for using the toll road, for example, is also escalating but at different rates. Then you can get potentially mismatches between the two. And so some of the concerns that we've heard are where you're getting sort of making or recording losses initially and then sort of larger profits later on over the life of the concession. And so some of this is about whether there's some almost reverse economics in terms of how these payments are structured versus how they're then reflected in the financial statements.
This example you're giving sounds like rate-regulated industries.
Well, there is a degree of crossover here. There is, because we're often talking here about situations where the government will specify or have some say over the price that can be charged to the public for using the infrastructure. The key here is that the assets that are being used don't belong to the operator. They remain property of the government, hence having an intangible asset rather than a tangible one. But there is a crossover here.
How does it work? Sorry, go ahead.
No, you are.
How does it work with wireless spectrum, which is very similar? So wireless telco buys spectrum, effectively a right to use it. Sometimes it's regulated. How does that work in that situation? Seems to me that would be quite parallel.
Yeah, I'm not. As far as I'm aware, none of the telcos would apply IFRIC 12. Now, IFRIC 12, which is the guidance that we're looking at here, is specifically on looking at infrastructure. And so it tends to be focused on physical assets, so network assets in particular, such as...
If you book the right as an intangible asset, the right to use this wireless spectrum is an intangible asset. Yeah. Used to amortize back in the day, it doesn't anymore, and it's a regulated industry, but usually it's not regulated in terms of
price.
Of price,
no.
That's the key difference.
No.
Like your return on invest, your return on capital is. Right. I don't know, just something that just occurred to me.
Yeah. It has features of it.
Yeah.
It has features of it. So.
Okay, I'm just thinking about Marietta.
I just wanted to follow on from what you said. I completely agree, and I don't actually think that the mismatch between the increase in the rate for the asset and the increase in the rate that you can charge your customers is necessarily a reason to throw that concept out the window, because I think in any industry you can have a very similar situation where you have to increase the wages of your employees in line with some union tariff or just in line with what is being paid to people with a similar skill set, which might not be industry specific, and at the same time the rate increases that you can actually get from your customers can depend a lot on what the capacity utilization in the industry is, what your overall pricing power is, so it might be higher or lower. I still think it there probably is a difference between just regular operating cost and operating cost that kind of arises in the context of a special concession. But nonetheless, I just think that the mismatch, to me, that's not an argument.
Okay.
Okay.
Good. Thank you for your input. So the update for the Interpretations Committee was in the paper that we had this morning. Is there anything anybody wants to raise? That's right.
So it's in Agenda Paper 1 from page 26 onwards, sets out what's currently on the Interpretation Committee's agenda. Also included in the slide pack that we've just been looking at, slides 18 and 19, give you a little bit of an overview of the activity of the committee over the last 2.5 years, showing, first of all, on slide 18, how the Interpretations Committee has dealt with a number of issues. And I think that the one to highlight, of course, is agenda decisions. So agenda decisions where the Interpretations Committee has decided not to embark on any standard setting action, but in many cases has identified that there is sufficient guidance in the standard to be able to give comment on how the committee would approach the particular question that had been raised, and thereby, through explaining that, provide some level of guidance to those who are affected by that sort of issue. And then slide 19 just shows you the standards that have been generating the most activity for the Interpretations Committee over the last couple of years. IFRS's 10 and 11, just to comment on those having come into effect in 2013 or, in the case of Europe, 2014, we do tend to find naturally that the more recent standards do generate a degree of submissions to the committee whilst people start to get to grips with those standards, and then typically the level of questions would tail off as people get more familiar with them. There's maybe a couple of others which tend to have a consistent level of questions coming through because of some of the difficulties in applying them. IS 12, IS 5, both fairly sort of a lot of sort of detailed rules, including the guidance there, that sometimes makes it a little trickier to apply and hence generating more questions. But yes, happy to take any questions that you may have about the work of the committee or the current agenda that it has.
Okay, no questions. All right, thanks very much, Andrew and team. So we'll close the public part of the meeting. Thank you very much for all of your input. I found it particularly interesting and useful. So